This is the podcast for Wednesday, March 6th, 2013, Theories of Knowledge. Oh, then if you want to vote on this, the ASLCC elections, you got to vote on Express Lane. I think you have till tomorrow to do that. You have to decide whether these sort of special interest clubs get extra money out of your student fees if you don't vote. Or vote yes, you want them to take more of your money to go to only certain clubs. If you vote no, that means that you think that every club ought to get an equal amount. I guess that's it as far as announcements go. So let's get right into discussing more about religious knowledge. So last time we were talking about Hume on miracles. So Hume has an argument against miracles, which is sort of an a priori argument. It's kind of a strange thing for an empiricist to say. So Hume says, first you have to understand what a miracle is. He says a miracle is, and remember how he defines a miracle? What is a miracle? Is it just something unusual or weird? Hume actually has a specific definition for a miracle.
Is it like something that goes against just natural laws?
Excellent. A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. I'm trying to remember people's names too. Tell me your name again.
My name?
Yeah.
Cody.
Cody, okay, yeah. Okay, so a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, says Cody. Correct the mundo. And then Hume goes on to say the laws of nature have no exceptions. And then he concludes by saying a miracle can never occur. So what do you think about this as an argument? A miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. Like, say, the laws of nature say, you know, there's gravity. Gravity, it's not just a suggestion, it's the law. And what is a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, like somebody floating without any support. Since the laws, but that just doesn't happen. The laws of nature don't have any violations. And therefore, that's why they're called the laws of nature, right? They're laws. Therefore, a miracle can never occur. So no matter what somebody tells you about what they experienced, it's not a miracle. There's some explanation of it in terms of the laws of nature. Did you have a comment?
Doesn't Hume not even believe in nature?
Okay, there you go. What are the laws of nature?
Yeah, what defines nature? And therefore, laws of nature.
Problems. One might be like the laws of nature. I mean, what are the when people talk about the laws of nature, we could say scientific laws.
He doesn't even believe in cause and effect.
Right. Hume doesn't believe in the material world. Or cause and effect. That seems like a pretty big problem, right? It seems like a glaring inconsistency. Hume, all of a sudden, he's become a realist with regard to cause and effect. He's like, well, there's the laws of nature, of course, and the laws of nature can be never be violated. Isn't this the guy that said you don't know whether the sun's going to rise tomorrow? Right? Isn't the guy that said, who says that since you can always imagine something different happening, there's no necessary connection between cause and effect? So that seems like Hume, at least, is being inconsistent.
Did he state that cause and effect before? He stated that miracles are violation of
Yeah, so the section on cause and effect comes earlier in his work. So, but by the time he gets here, all of a sudden he's switching positions, it seems. Now, Hume might just say, well, by law's nature, I just mean the constant conjunction of objects or the regularity we observe in nature. And you might say, our experience shows us this regularity in nature, and we never see exceptions. But then, how do you know there's not going to be a miracle tomorrow? And Hume would say, if you can't know that the sun's going to rise tomorrow, how can you not know that somebody's not going to walk on water, or that somebody did walk on water 2,000 years ago?
He could say that miracles are only possible in the future. Miracles didn't occur in the past, they're occurring now, but they could theoretically occur.
But how do you know, so you read in the Bible, say, that Jesus walked on water. And you take Hume's argument, you say, well, look, it's not possible to walk on water without violating the laws of nature, therefore that didn't happen. But somebody's writing down, they're telling you that happened. Why are you dismissing it out of hand? If you can't know the sun will rise tomorrow, how can you know that somebody didn't walk on water in the past? Why is it important it was in the future? This is something which someone says happens in the past based on testimony. Now, you've never seen anybody walk on water, but you've never seen the sun not rise. But Hume's saying it's possible the sun doesn't rise tomorrow. Well, why isn't it equally possible that somebody walked on water sometime in the past? I mean, how do we know this? Like, what's our evidence for this? Is it true by definition or what? Yeah?
Cause and effect.
Cause and effect, yeah. Right? But the laws of cause and effect, you know, what a miracle is a violation of those laws. So it seems like you're begging if you say why can't a miracle occur? Because of the laws of cause and effect. A miracle is a violation of the laws of cause and effect. And then what would you say? The laws of cause and effect have no violations. Well, how do you know that? Because the laws of cause and effect have no exceptions. How do you know that? Well, we've never seen any. Well, this guy says that he saw Jesus walk on water, and he wrote it down in the book. How do you know that didn't happen? Because it's a miracle. Why aren't there miracles? Because the laws of nature have no exceptions. Right? Yeah.
Miracles are like bending the rules. Mm-hmm. Like when we put like a 747 in the air, it's like it's on the ground and it's going to stay on the ground until it moves fast enough. And it seems like in itself, it's just like, oh my god, how did we get that thing up in the air? It like seems like a miracle, but we like it's like kind of bending of like the air and stuff. It's like in itself, it's like kind of like bending what we know to like
direction.
Make what we want work.
Same thing
with like. Big ships, for the Air Force and stuff like that.
It's kind of weird when you think about like what are the laws of nature anyway? Like, what if I were to say, well, Jesus didn't suspend the law of gravity. What happened was he created a warp in the space-time continuum, and which allowed him to walk on top of the water. So it wasn't that gravity was suspended, he just used the laws of nature to bring about a certain effect that we've never seen before or something.
Or right? He somehow managed to not break the surface tension of the water.
Yeah, there you go, right. Or maybe he took the water molecules and he made them, like, every time he stepped, he made the water molecules, like, all move together really fast so that they formed, like, a non-permeable surface. Or he increased the surface tension of the water so great that it held his weight.
Yeah. Or perhaps his weight was very, very small, like he was very light.
Yeah, maybe Jesus generated anti-gravity waves.
He's less dense than the water somehow.
Oh, you hear about, like, you know, people working on anti-gravity. They actually have some, they're just working on some weird devices like propulsion devices that are supposed to be anti-gravity.
Yeah, and there are anti-gravity. It's like if you like go on a plane and it goes down at a certain speed and like at a certain angle, it'll feel like you're on the moon, or it'll feel like there's no gravity.
perhaps the so-called vomit comet. And imagine like vomit floating around in zero G's. That doesn't sound pretty. But yeah, it's like you get sick from the G-force. Well, that's how they train astronauts. You're with this for about 30 seconds. But that's just because why? Because you're like going down a really, you know, steep angle. But, you know, maybe this is just God manipulating existing laws of nature. But then, I think, what might Hume say about that?
There's no God.
Well, I suppose he might say that. But how would he really rule it out, you know, out of hand?
It wasn't a miracle.
Yeah, it seems like he just says, well, it wasn't a miracle. Why not? Because it's a violation of the laws of nature. But how do you know the laws of nature never have any exceptions? You might just say, like, first, so it seems like, how do you know this? Well, it's because you're already assuming this. And you're assuming this, right? So if you know this because you're assuming this, it's hard to explain this. But can you see how this is a circular reasoning? Like, suppose I would say, everything in the Bible is true. The Bible is the Word of God. And you say, well, how do you know that? I say right here in 1 Timothy 3:16, it says every word of Scripture is inspired by God, right? So so I'm quoting the Bible. It's right there in the Bible. How do you know that's true? Because everything in the Bible is true. It's the Word of God. Right? It's a circular argument. And so in the same way, how do you know a miracle can never occur? Well, miracles are violation of the laws of nature, and of course, the laws of nature, we know they have no exception. Well, how do you know that? Because a miracle has never happened, right? So it seems like you're begging the question. You're assuming what you're trying to prove. Yeah.
Yeah. And if somebody just tried to explain this to me and say that miracles don't occur, I would say, well, I would have to see it to believe it. This wouldn't be enough. It's only conceptual.
Yeah. It's. And speaking of being sort of conceptual. It seems like this is an a priori argument, too. This is like a... Which Hume makes this argument that you can never prove anything a priori when you're talking about a matter of fact and existence. The a priori arguments can only tell you about concepts and about how ideas are related to one another. They can't tell you about what exists. That to know what exists, you have to use your senses. And so you'd have to do a survey of, you know, has anybody ever seen the miracle? Yeah, Olive.
I mean, the definition of miracle is a surprising and welcome event that's not explicable by natural or scientific laws. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, that's the definition. It's like saying truth doesn't exist or lies don't exist because they're not true. Well, duh. They're not true. That's why they're lies.
But then it's more like, so that's like about the definition of lying, but what if I were to say, I don't know, no one has ever lied or something like that. Then you could like look at the evidence. I'm trying to think of like some parallel argument.
You're lying.
suppose we get a liar's paradox or something. Matthew.
She reminded me of Lewis, when Bill Maher was interviewing this guy about why he's religious, and he says it's because he saw all these miracles occur, and he's like, well, name a miracle. He's like, well, I asked for it to rain, and I stuck my hand on the window and it started to rain. And he's just like, okay, like, are you getting to the miracle point, or was that it? Like, I wouldn't consider it a miracle either. So it's like, it's very skim on the definition of miracle.
Yeah, what is a miracle? It might be like the timing of something, but you think about like, oh, like, you know, especially if the guy lives in Eugene or something like that, it rains every time you turn around. So if you happen to be praying for rain, you know, it might happen the next day, and the two things, it's like people, they notice, like, I got home and the clock on my in my car said 11:11. I'm like, ooh, what does that mean? Yeah, but it's like, is gonna say that one time or another. You know, given the hours that I keep, that's probably a likely occurrence that's gonna happen sometime. But you notice those times where it's like something striking, like you see 1111, and you're like, oh, that's really unusual. But you know, given all the other permutations, is God turn up sometime, right? So, but you, for, because you're a pattern seeking person, as all human beings are, it sort of looks special to you. And then all the other times in your talks at different times that didn't seem meaningful, you just ignore all of those, which makes the 1-1-1-1 seem all the more special. And then you want to, you know, maybe want to go inside and call Coast to Coast AM and say, hey, George Norrie, what's with this? I looked at my clock and it said 11:11, and I hear like there's a lot of that going around. What does it mean? And he'd say, I don't know, Jeff, it's just very strange.
Yeah. Could a miracle be defined as merely a law of nature that we don't understand or have no capacity to understand? Like the fifth dimension, for example. Like you can make two different choices and live out, you know, those two different lives from that, those two different choices, but we don't live in the fifth dimension, so we have no capacity to understand it. So it would seem like a miracle to us. But to another being who does have that capacity to understand, you know, it's just everyday life to them.
Would that mean like
that was just
antibiotics would be a miracle to like somebody who lived in the Middle Ages?
Exactly.
But then after you explain it, it goes from being a miracle to not being a miracle. I mean, is miracle just a placeholder for something we can't explain through natural means, or is it a supposed violation of the laws of nature? It seems like then maybe there might be some difference, because then, I mean, under your definition, scientists believe in miracles, or everyone believes in miracles, because everyone believes there are some things that science can't explain at the present moment. So that means like there would be a lot of things that would have to be called miracles that most people might not think about as miracles. Olive.
Yeah, it seems like there's a miracle that has to do with God, and then there's an atheist miracle that's like amazing, unusual event, possibly like a scientific achievement. It's a miracle of engineering. It was a miracle of this or that. And, I mean, it seems like Hume would probably agree with those, but it also just feels like a figure of speech at that point. Miracle seems to have some kind of connection with God, or, you know, theology of God, or something like that.
Yes, you might put this, you know, caused by divine agency. Or spiritual forces or something.
I guess we wouldn't, if a miracle is truly a violation of the laws of nature, we wouldn't even be able to call it a miracle, because we wouldn't know what it is. It would just
happen. There'd be no laws if there could be exceptions.
Yeah.
Willy-nilly. So miracles couldn't exist because they're just chance happenings.
Well, maybe the laws of nature like function 99% of the time, but there's exceptions. Like, for example, the laws of physics break down when you go inside a black hole. They don't apply in the same way. So under certain conditions, the ordinary laws of nature don't apply. So couldn't God, if there is a God and he created nature, couldn't he abrogate his laws just for a moment when he wanted to do something? If he's an omnipotent being, could he just step in and make a change, turn water into wine, or part the Red Sea, or whatever he wanted to do without, you know, having to follow the laws that he created? Yeah.
So why are miracles always a positive thing? Like, you could take a miracle, like in the sound of thunder when he kills the butterfly and changes everything. Like, I don't know, it's like, why is it always positive? A violation of the laws of nature shouldn't always be a good thing, right?
That's true. You have like things like sorcery, I suppose, magic and evil sorcery.
There's one of the last commandments where the you know, the firstborn Egyptian son gets taken away. It's kind of a horrible thing for the firstborn dies.
Yeah, whether a miracle is good or bad might depend on your point of view.
Yeah. Like, the plagues.
The plague, right. So the ten plagues of the Egyptians might have seemed great for the Israelites, but really bad for the Egyptians. That's a good point. Yeah, there is a lot of ambiguity in the notion of a miracle. And typically it's thought of being something that's good
and it's caused by, you know, it's sort of this idea that it's kind of a positive thing. Maybe a miracle should be distinguished from something that's supernatural. Maybe a miracle is a good, something that's done by good, positive spiritual forces or God, as opposed to malevolent forces.
Yeah, because like a ghost would be a violation of laws of nature. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go, like a ghost.
You'd be like, that's a miracle. You'd be like, oh, shit, that's a ghost.
The ghost thing is kind of interesting, too, because suppose someone says, I have a ghost in my house, and he's playing bagpipes. I was actually listening to an old-time radio show last night based on a Rudyard Kipling story where there's a guy with a ghost in his house who's playing bagpipes.
Wow.
And you never find out whether the ghost was real or not, or whether it was some being put up by this guy's fiance, by his best friend, or by his manservant. This happens and takes place in India. But suppose, you know, is it a miracle even if it's a put up job? Because it was inexplicable at the end, the guy doesn't know. The story is being narrated by the manservant. The guy never figures out whether the ghost was real. All of a sudden one day the bagpipes stop. You know, he looks around, tries to figure out where the bagpipes are coming from. He can't find where the noise is coming from, and he concludes it's a ghost. So, on your definition, if it's just something that's inexplicable, if there's a naturalistic explanation but it's never found, then it still counts as a miracle. And that seems kind of weird. So, there is some ambiguity in the notion of, you know, what a miracle is. But I think if you stick with Hume's definition of a violation of the laws of nature, that it's really begging the questions to say the laws of nature have no exceptions. Because, you know, how do you know that? First, there's two alternatives, right? You might say this is a priori and a posteriori. So, suppose you say the laws of nature have no exceptions, it's a priori. It's like a bachelor is an unmarried male. If it's a law of nature, then it has no exception. Otherwise, it's not a law. Okay. Well, then you have a nice little syllogism here. But then, how do you know? It seems like this is question vague because you're assuming the laws of nature have no violation. But what's your evidence for that? Well, you might say it's the meaning of the word law. But how do you know? Then the question is, are there such things as scientific laws which have no exceptions? And then you can go back to Hume's own arguments about cause and effect, I suppose. And then you're left with the question, again, if there is a God and he created the world, it seems like, why would he, and he's an omnipotent being, he wouldn't be bound by the laws of nature. Suppose you say it's a posteriori, it's based on the senses. Well, then you have all the reports of miracles that have already been made, and there's a lot of them, right? A lot of people will tell you they've seen a miracle of some kind or other. There's probably a few people in this room that have seen something they believe to be a divine miracle. And let's, again, forget about a miracle. Every time that you ever look at a sunset, ever see a baby born, that's a miracle. So that's just like, as Al said, it's kind of a colloquial thing where it's something sort of amazing and astounding and wonderful or something. But in the sense of violation of laws of nature, there's lots of people who have experiences they take to be of miraculous happenings, and lots of, you know, stories of people doing miracles in the past from found in sacred scriptures. And there's a lot of religions right now where you go in and you see faith healing and people have demons cast out of them and all sorts of stuff that people regard as miraculous. So it seems like either you're begging the question or the argument's going to be really weak in some way. So it's either a circular reasoning, like the guy says, the Bible's the word of God. Why? It says so right here. Where does it say that? In the Bible. Well, how do you know that's true? Because the Bible is true, right? It's a circular reasoning. Miracles can never happen. How do you know that? Well, miracles violate the laws of nature. Well, why can't the laws of nature be violated? They just can't, right? Well, how do I know that? Well, because miracles never happen. Have you ever seen a miracle? I think Hume might try to get around this by pointing to this importance of first-person experience. Versus testimony. Maybe this is how he might get around some of this. Yeah, Hume would say this is what you go with all the time. And so going back to his earlier argument that testimony is always weaker than first-hand experience, then as long as you've never seen a miracle, you might be justified in believing miracles don't work. And you might say, well, show me a miracle. And yeah, I'm still waiting for somebody to show me a bona fide miracle that I have no explanation for. I hear lots of stories and I see stuff on TV, but I've never seen one firsthand. So, but maybe someday I'll be surprised. Let's see. Well, how about maybe this argument? So sometimes people will say, you have a person who believes in a religion based on the Bible. And they'll say, look, you have all these stories written, and they point to particular people and places and things that we know existed. It's written in historical narrative form. And it says some fantastic things happened, but how do you know miracles didn't happen back then? Maybe they don't happen today. Maybe they just happen now and again. But maybe back then miracles would happen all the time. Why wouldn't you be justified in believing that? What if you say, look, so it says in the Bible, say that God parted the Red Sea, and if you and they've even found like chariot wheels at the bottom of the Red Sea, they know that there was a migration of the people called the Abiru that came from out of Egypt and into Palestine. There's some issue about what time period it was and whether it was a bloody war of conquest as opposed to a migration. But the basic idea that the Israelites were in Egypt and came into Palestine is established. And suppose you find that chariot wheel at the bottom of the Red Sea. And so if someone says, well, no, this is ridiculous, the Red Sea didn't part, that's just a myth. Well, what's your? I mean, why would you necessarily believe in that unless you are presupposing that there is no God and therefore no miracle can ever occur?
Wait, why would you?
It seems like you're sort of begging a question. You're having a prejudicial view in that you're presupposing there is no God, therefore there can be no miracles, therefore that didn't happen. It's just a story. That seems to be a kind of a circular reasoning in the same way that Hume is engaged in circular reasoning. You're dismissing something out of hand because it doesn't agree with your presuppositions. Or think about there's a prophecy about the birth of Jesus. And if you add up the years, this is from the book of Daniel, and if you add up the years, you end up with around the time that Jesus was crucified, 20... around 29 BC, or 29 AD is when Jesus was crucified. And if you look at the years in the book of Daniel and this prophecy which is given, it talks about the Messiah being cut off from his people, and it's exactly that year. Or there's another prophecy about the fall of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre is this big sea empire. It was a world power at the time, and there's a prophecy that it would be brought low and that not one stone would be left upon another. That it would just, and that it would be pushed into the sea. As it turns out, Alexander the Great came along. He wanted to conquer the people of Tyre, and he had a problem that he didn't have a navy. The Tyre was his big sea power. Alexander didn't have a navy. So what did he do? Well, he took all these rocks and rubble and garbage and just basically dumped it into the sea over a period of months. I think it took him even more than a year. And basically he just started dumping gravel and rocks into the sea, and he built this this bridge of garbage and rubble going out to the island of Tyre so he could get his army out there, and he conquered it and he decimated the city and destroyed it. And it's something that's in the Bible. Now, what most people will say is, scholars will say, oh, well, the book of Daniel must have been written in the 2nd century. Why? Because there's no such thing as prophecy. So therefore, this must be like some basically somebody writing after this has already happened, and then writing it as if it were a prophecy written before it happened. Why? Because it's impossible to predict the future through supernatural knowledge. Well, it seems like it's a circular argument. What do you think? So isn't the person, person who believes in the Bible's revelation, why wouldn't they be justified in believing those things happened just as they did? Isn't the person who's an atheist or a skeptic or agnostic, don't they have a prejudicial view towards miracles which color their analysis of all these miracles that are purported to have happened according to the Bible?
Skeptical secondhand accounts.
Yeah, but when they read about, like, I don't know, think of something else. Caesar crossed the Rubicon in 46 BC. They don't say, oh, that, how do I know that happened? They're like, oh, it's in the history book. It was written by Suetonius. And so Suetonius said, I believe it, that settles it. Why do they believe Caesar crossed the Rubicon, but they have a problem with Moses crossing the Red Sea? Seems like it's a prejudicial view based on their atheism. And why don't they believe in God? Well, maybe they don't like the idea of an omnipotent judge who's going to judge their moral conduct. They're hiding their black heart and trying to run from God. Or whatever. Like, people have lots of different reasons for not believing in God, not all of which are based on evidence, right? What do you think? What would you say if someone would say, look, you're just being prejudiced against this record of history written by people who were living about that time, who recorded what they observed, and why? Because you have a prejudice against the supernatural. Yeah.
I guess what I'd say to them is they don't have a right to be prejudiced against the time, but more like, the fact that the Bible is translated to English and obviously it wasn't written in English, so I think they'd be justified to say that, maybe the person who translated didn't quite get something right. Maybe, it really is the Reed Sea instead of the Red Sea, and if it was the Reed Sea, that would perfectly explain why the tide would massively go in and out at random times.
So what if, think about, Suetonius. Suetonius wasn't written in English either, right? He's written in Latin. I took Greek, not Latin. If it was Thucydides or Herodotus, I could read it. The translation isn't like necessarily rocket science. So what most people would say, Caesar crossed the Rubicon, or the 300 Spartans fought against 10,000 Persians at the Pass of Thermopylae. Most people accept that as historical fact. There probably wasn't like a giant and, a sorceress and all kinds of crazy stuff and people fighting slow-mo and talking like this, but that's like a historical, accepted historical fact. But all of a sudden, when you're talking about the walls of Jericho falling out, for example, people say that's probably just a silly story. Why? Because it's in the Bible. And the Bible was written by a bunch of religious wackos, and so we can't trust it. Besides, miracles don't happen, right? So you can't blow a trumpet and have a wall come down. That assumes there's a God and he can do things in the world, which we obviously know is not true. Yeah.
Religion aside, the perception of the people that wrote these stories didn't have a very full understanding of what science was and the laws of nature.
I suppose, right? So... But does that, change what they observed?
Their justification of the truth might just be a little bit off.
I mean, to me, it would be pretty astounding. Like, if I was, one of the Israelites and all these plagues that had come down to the Egyptians and then were being pursued by Pharaoh's army, and then I see Moses, our leader, going up there, and he, like,
puts his hands in the air like that, and the sea parts, and there's like dry land, and we run across, and as soon as we get across, the Egyptian army is like halfway across and closes in on him. That would make me believe I would be one of those guys grumbling out there in the wilderness and doomed to die before I saw the promised land, because that would make a believer out of me. And even if like it was sort of, you know, air currents or something like, you know, meteorologically that might have happened anyway, it seems like an awfully big coincidence. Like the timing was everything there, right? So, well, let me try another tack. So there's another story. Like if you read the Odyssey or the Iliad. So not the Iliad. So the Iliad's about Troy. People used to think that Troy was a myth. There was no such city. And then somebody dug it up, and there actually was a city of Troy. And the Greeks actually did siege the city of Troy. But if you look in the historical record, it says things like that Homer makes. So Homer talks about there's like a fight, and one guy's about to spear another guy, and it says that Apollo turned away his spear. Right? Or Athena drove home the point of the blade, and his soul went gibbering down to Hades, or what have you, right? So you get mention of the Greek pantheon there in the Iliad. So now here's a question, you know, did the Greek gods exist too? Or do the Greek gods exist? And then you think, Or you look at like the Bhagavad Gita, and you've got a story of like Krishna. And Krishna appears to Arjuna, who's a prince. And I think the historicity of Arjuna is a lot more questionable. But you get like a long genealogy at the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, where it's talking about all the historical background of all the kings and where Prince Arjuna came from and who he was descended from and so on. So it looks like a historical narrative. And then he starts talking about talking with Krishna. Well, does Krishna exist too? Would you have to believe in Krishna? And then what do you do when Yahweh says, oh, there's no other gods besides me? And then Krishna says, oh, there's like millions of gods, but they're all like manifestations of the one ultimate reality. And it seems like there's a conflict in what like the different gods say, right?
Yeah. The Bhagavad Gita was part of the Mahabharata.
It is. So, and are you just saying that it's not a standalone book?
Or? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, the Mahabharata, which is like this big epic poem, and it has references to
like
all the
people.
Yeah, there's like Hanuman, the monkey god, and there's all kinds of miracles, right? In the Bhagavad Gita, there's miracles. There aren't a lot of miracles in the Quran, but in the Hadith, there's some miracles about Muhammad. There's one. I went to the what's that?
What about the Buddhist Bible? Or whatever there.
So the Buddhism actually so when Buddha has his awakening, it says like all of a sudden the Buddha decides, I'm going to sit here and meditate until I get the truth of the universe, and he sits in the lowest position and he sits there, and it says that when he finally gets the revelation of the Four Noble Truths, that the earth shook like a drunken maiden, and flower blossoms came from heaven, like all these sort of apocalyptic events, miraculous things happen. And it talks about the god of death, is trembled or something. So there's stuff going on there too. Yeah. So, one of the problems with miracles is if you take these accounts, at face value, you have a bunch of different miracles with competing claims with different gods, and they all say, we're the true religion, we got the true God, and here are all of our miracles. So I'm trying to remember the one, I think Muhammad is, I went to the mosque, and there's a mosque here down in town, so I went to the mosque one Friday for Friday prayers, and there was a speaker, and he was talking about this passage in the Hadith, which are the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, where the Prophet Muhammad used to speak, and he'd lean against this tree. And then finally one of his followers said, hey, our prophet shouldn't have to lean against this tree. I'm going to make him a lectern. So this person made a lectern. And then Muhammad started using the lectern, and then the tree spoke and said, hey, I'm really lonely. I used to love it when you used to lean on me all the time, Muhammad. Why don't you get rid of that lectern and lean on me again? And Muhammad just had compassion on the tree, and he went back to leaning on the tree. So that was like that's a miracle in Islam. See, did that really happen? Was Muhammad hearing voices? Did the tree speak an audible voice that other people heard? Yeah.
But aren't a lot of the stories in these like texts really like supposed to really represent like morals and stuff, and not necessarily true? I mean, like Joseph Campbell said, most of it is like really like supposed to be interpreted in like find where like the morals lie and stuff, and like the meaning of the story.
Yeah. If you look at these stories in their historical, cultural context, it looks like these people really believe the things that they wrote, like in a literal way, not in a figurative way. Now, I think somebody like Joseph Campbell, who's an academic who really likes these stories as literature, he wants to peddle them to modern audiences as something which is relevant. So he has like a book called Myths to Live By. And he's more interested in like he has sort of a social goal of bringing people together and trying to find a way where everybody can be right and nobody can be wrong. And the only way to do that is by trying to find some sort of figurative meaning and say that's the true meaning and say these people didn't really believe these things literally. But if you look at you know people accounts from people living at the time, you had a few intellectuals and skeptics, but the majority of people believed you know in miracles and in all kinds of what we would now today regard as crazy superstitions. They didn't have science to tell them about the world, and they had all kinds of beliefs about the world that we don't accept today. Although certain parts of the world you can go, people, you know, go to Central or South America and you'll find people with all kinds of superstitious beliefs about the supernatural. They believe in the chupacabra and the evil eye and hexes. And I mean, go to Haiti, right? And the people believe in the voodoo rituals and hexes and spells and things. I'm sorry, you wanted to...
Yeah. I
forget. So, sorry, I was going on a little bit there. But I mean, you can go around the world. You can go to sub-Saharan Africa, and there's still like people being burned as witches. I mean, people are stoned to death. Yeah, go ahead.
Weren't the like how do we know that those stories weren't written by the intellectuals of the time, though? Like, if they were like being like creative writers or whatever, and they were like. Because I mean, if you read like a story, like it sounds like pretty believable if it's a good story, and like, but they don't like the writers don't believe that it's like true, you know? It's like if it's some like kind of like true, like that Japanese author who has like IQ 84,
Murakami.
Yeah, Murakami.
Well, I think that if you look at like how traditions develop. And I'm not sure, like, exactly the whole picture for this, but these things usually start out as a primitive oral tradition, and then they sort of get ensconced in culture, passed on from father to son, usually in some sort of priestly class, although sometimes, like, propagated out among the people, and then eventually they get written down. And most of the early religions start out as oral traditions. And so you can actually find references in the written tradition to the oral tradition. And so these things existed at a time you know, before people even had writing. And when people led a nomadic existence, living in tents, moving from place to place. And so there you don't have division of labor, you don't have... a literate class, you don't have a way to sort of keep records. And so I think that might be like a part of it. So these early traditions are written by, you know, in the Middle Eastern religion, written by primitive Bedouins.
Doubting a human intelligence, because don't we all have like the same basic capacity to like think, because we're all human. And so aren't you kind of like... like you probably because of like some sort of necessarily the culture that they are as intellectual as we are, or something. Aren't you kind of doubting their ability, to come up with ideas? And...
Not necessarily, because I would say, like, to think that a person living, say, 5,000 years ago could figure out all the scientific truths that we as human beings have worked over the centuries to discover is not really tenable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, look at the Middle Ages, though. Like, we lost all of the knowledge from Rome.
Okay, yeah, sure. So there's 1,000 years of darkness or whatever. I mean, there were things that go on in the Middle Ages, but I see your point. But you think about, like, one of the things that I think it was Sir Isaac Newton that said, if I've accomplished anything, it's only because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. And so Newton was basing his work on Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus and all the scientists that came before him. And those guys were based their learning on the Greco-Roman learning that they picked up in the Renaissance. So it's like this long, arduous process of discovering what the world's like. So to expect people at the very beginning of civilization to know what the score is, I think, is expecting a lot. And to think that they're sort of, they have modern sensibilities and sophistication is an iffy proposition. Even about things like morality. And today we accept that racism and sexism and, you know, homophobia and classism are all wrong. But you can look at not too far in our distant future where people saw those as perfectly acceptable and normal. Sexism, throw that in there too. I mean, women only had the right to vote. You know, Nadia, it hasn't been 100 years that women had the right to vote. Women were treated as property for most of the history of Western civilization. Yeah?
I guess when we're talking about, like, the idea of where religion came from, I'm always kind of put into question, you know, what was their state of consciousness at the time? Because, I mean, visionary plants and fungus have been around far longer than humans have. You know, every civilization, you can read through the history books and find out that they had some access to some psychotropic molecule in some way, shape, or form. And so, you know, it's not that all these people are having these religious miracles. They just happen to be growing wheat in their fields that just so happen to be infested with ergot, and they're making it into their bread, eating their bread, and they will experience St. Anthony's fire to them and to the entire town because they're all eating the bread. You know, all these miracles are happening, you know.
Rye bread.
Yes. And then, but now...
Wheat's okay. Stay away from the rye.
Yeah,
especially if it's been sitting around for a while.
Albert Hofmann in 1938 discovered, you know, what was going on with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we still can't explain what's going on with, you know, psychedelic molecules, but...
And there's actually some evidence for that in Hinduism. In the old Vedic texts, you have the Vedas, which are the earliest texts of Hinduism, and there's a passage that says, we have drunk the soma, we have seen the gods. And so you get, in Native American spirituality, tribes use peyote, which is a hallucinogen too. I'm not sure you could explain, what's that?
Frankincense and myrrh, together they're hallucinogens.
And then the Greeks, they had this secret, like, underground fraternity, and it centered around this ritual of drinking ergot-infested wine. Aristotle did it, all the famous philosophers
did it.
Yeah, they
would do it during the harvest festival.
Yep.
Every year.
And then they would drink the wine, and, you know, it all... fry balls, and then that's kind of where I feel mythology came out of, is them riding on those experiences.
That's where the base of our civilization comes from.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
it's
in
a book called The Road to Ulysses. It's an old book from the 60s.
The Road to Ulysses. I'll have to check that out.
Basically, he states that, you know, it's very highly probable that language and religion were based off early Stone Age men, you know, eating hallucinogens.
Spell Ulysses. Ulysses. Oh, yes.
That's right.
There's also, you know, there's all kinds of theories about how religion came about. There's another one that's like the origin of religion in the bicameral mind or something like that, that talks about how in early man, the hemispheres weren't separated. And that early man may have had something like schizophrenia, where he would actually hear voices.
And then after that, we got sort of read out of the gene pool that those experiences of hearing the voices still sort of, it got into culture, and then you get a shame, and maybe get a few people who would still hear the voices every once in a while, or there would be traditions about people who would hear voices, and every once in a while you get a prophet or a priest or a person thought to have spiritual powers, and the person basically has some form of mental illness, but they're treated as, you know, being in touch with the spiritual world in a world before psychology or neuroscience or what have you. I don't think you need any of those things to explain religion, because you have religious movements popping up in the 19th century. You have people that have spiritual experiences that say God is speaking to them, and they get a following, and stuff like that happens all the time. And maybe they have some form of schizophrenia. Maybe they're mentally ill. Maybe they just, it might just be that they're looking for attention or money or power or what have you. And sometimes the unconscious mind can cook up a bunch of things too. So you get people who hear voices or experience automatic writing or have dreams and visions, and these things might be just something that's bubbling up for their unconscious mind. Yeah.
There's always that, remember Canaan, and it depicts the third eye, and now they think, scientists think, you know, they're depicting the pineal gland, and through very ritualistic societies, they would find ways to stimulate the pineal gland, either through stress or through, like, songs, you know, humming a specific tune at a very specific frequency, sound goes in your ears, vibrates that little pineal gland. In the pineal gland, you have serotonin-related compounds, that particularly dimethyltryptamine, and your pineal gland kind of releases that into your brain very subtly, and it causes a very strong hallucinogenic effect. But you're producing it endogenously. You don't have to eat any plant or any drug. You know, just a little bit of stress.
It's also released when you dream.
Exactly.
So you can get into like some kind of REM state. And if you're consuming some kind of MAOI also, you have some kind of spiritual existence or experience.
Endogenous neurochemicals, I guess.
So hallucinogens. Patrick.
When he was saying, there's cultures that do like trances, and it's just, you know, a bunch of music played over and over again, and then, you know, they like start going crazy, and they say they talk to their forefathers. I mean, there's a huge conspiracy about the pineal gland, you know, and fluoride, you know, blocks it.
That's what's great about living in the Grove. No fluoridated water.
Yay.
Do they have fluoridated water in Eugene?
No.
Up here in the big city? Oh,
no.
That's cool, too.
Anything in the western side of
like toothpaste and
right.
But, like, you know, supposedly the government has to watch you use your third eye to see the truth.
So, here's the question. Why favor these naturalistic explanations?
They don't violate laws of nature.
But how do you know the laws of nature have no violations? You're interpreting all these purported miracles in terms of, you're like, oh, there's got, you're going back to like the David Blaine thing, it's got to be a trick. Well, why does it have to be a trick? Why does it always have to be a trick? Maybe there are some fake miracles, and maybe there's some miracles, maybe 90% are explicable through natural phenomenon, but why say it's always got to be that way? Isn't it a form of anti-supernaturalist prejudice?
I guess it depends how you're at it.
What's that?
They always do it open with their dad.
I think Kant would go right along with that, because, you know, all those subjects, you know, they lower our brain's filters, therefore allowing us to experience a greater spectrum of consciousness. And, you know, instead hallucinogens, mass hysteria, or the unconscious mind wears off, you know, those filters go back up, and you're filtering out a lot of those extrasensory consciousness perceptions.
Now, your view sounds like it's like the hallucinogens and some of these other things open your eyes to, like, some sort of reality that And it's not just like you're just not having experiences that don't refer to anything.
I just like what Kant said, you know, that our mind acts as a filter.
Right. I mean, you're turning off the filters, but I think, I mean, most people's interpretation of hallucinogens, they, you know, they call you have hallucination, which is an experience that doesn't represent reality. Matthew.
Well, yeah, but what about the scientist that was tripping and discovered what the DNA ladder looked like because he was frying up and it melted into the right form and wrote it down and later it was correct. So if you can't hallucinate and not see reality, but that caused him to understand reality.
Was that like Watson or Crick? You know those guys?
I don't remember who.
Either smoking dope. I don't know.
Linus Pauling thought he got it, but he ended up being wrong, and some other guy was right.
It might just be like a coincidence. Or sometimes it might be like you have a bunch of thoughts, you know, in your head, and maybe what the drugs do, they sort of like cause you to see a connection that you didn't see before or something. They affect your brain in some way that allows some sort of happy accident. But coming back to the larger point about, like, you're saying, oh, well, a person has this experience, there's something going on in their brain. And so you think they're either got a brain disease or they're taking a drug or they're doing something which is making them see something that's not there.
But
why not just see that they're actually experiencing another reality or that they're in touch with spiritual agencies? Like, think about, like, a voodoo ritual, right? So you have, like, people get together and they're banging the drums, you know, and people are you know, they've been to this ritual a bunch of times before, and now you're going to be possessed by the spirit of the snake god, and you're like dancing around, right, and getting and all of a sudden you're like, you're kind of swaying around, and then all of a sudden you have like some woman falls to the ground, she's like writhing the ground like a snake and sticking her tongue out, you know, and she's possessed by the snake god. And like that, you know, your social psychologist or anthropologist is going to say something like, well, what happens is the beating of the drums, the music, and like the sort of the group consciousness causes person to have an experience such that they believe they're, you know, possessed by the snake god, but it's all this sort of these social and psychological effects causing a person to have this illusory experience because we know the snake god doesn't exist. But why not? Why would you say that as opposed to saying, well, here's the ritual that brings the snake god, and the snake god only comes when you, you know, butter him up with praise and tell him how great he is and are open to his possession.
Well, why don't you just say they're crazy too?
Well, the question is, why would you say, whatever it is, it's not this real snake god? You're always looking for this naturalistic explanation, and the question is that a rational approach, or is that a prejudicial approach?
If you're saying the snake god doesn't exist, isn't it a prejudicial approach? But if a rational approach is, here is how you get the snake god to come to you.
Well, the rational, the objective approach might say, well, maybe it's a snake god, maybe it's not. And let's see what the evidence is. But it seems like the approach that most people take, and particularly most scientists, is, well, we know there's no such thing as the snake god, so let's figure out what the real story is. Let's try to figure out the psychology. Let's try to figure out the brain, you know, neuroscience behind this experience that gives rise to it.
I guess I have a question, like, do miracles, whether religious or not religious, do they have to be forced upon us, or can we somehow create the miracle ourselves through whatever rituals? Like, does the snake god have to come to us without us asking? Mm-hmm. Or if we call the snake god,
I guess it could be either way. Like, there was I can't remember, like the woman who channeled the spirit Ramtha, Jay-Z Knight, who lives up in Yelm, Washington. She had this story. She was building like a giant pyramid in her apartment or something. just mind her own business, and then mom hit her with the first revelation. She doesn't like trying looking for her spirit. She was trying to be more spiritual, I guess, but it came unbidden. Muhammad was just kind of poking around in caves when all of a sudden he was overcome by the angel Gabriel and fell to the ground and had his insides stirred with a stick when he was like 12 years old. That was kind of a weird experience. And then later on, he's walking around and this voice starts talking and telling him to read or recite. And he says, well, what should I recite? And the spirit keeps on telling him to recite. And then finally it tells him that he's supposed to recite God's message to his people. And you're the next prophet. And Muhammad's like terrified and thinks he might be possessed by an evil spirit. Tries to commit suicide a couple times. And it's just like freaked out, and it's like, you know, God's, you're the one God chose, and so that's something that, you know, it's something that was didn't that he wasn't looking for necessarily. You see a lot of this, the idea of the reluctant prophet is something that's common. Same thing with Moses. Moses was had fled Egypt because he was wanted for murder. He's kicking around in the desert, taking a walk in the hills. Likes to be by himself. All of a sudden, God appears to him in the form of a bush that's on fire, but not being consumed by the flame. And the bush starts speaking to him. Right? It's not like he was out there looking for God. So sometimes, and Muhammad's an interesting case in point. So when Muhammad would have these communications from the angel Gabriel, he would fall to the ground. His whole body would shake. His lips, his upper lip would quiver. His eyes would roll back in his head. He would sweat profusely, and then afterwards he would say, "Hey, here's the next revelation from the angel Gabriel." So, what do you think? Like, what do a neuroscientist say about him?
Epilepsy.
Yeah, there you go. Temporal lobe epilepsy. But then the question is like. It seems like the scientist or the scholar is going to say, well, you know, maybe it looks like Muhammad had epilepsy, and this is where Islam came from. Well, you know, you talk to a Muslim, he's not going to believe that, right? He's going to say, that's what you're blaspheming the prophet to say that he was mentally ill or he had some physical problem or what have you. But Muhammad even wondered whether he was crazy or whether he was demon-possessed. So those were his alternative explanations. But why would you, like, I think most people, like, confronted with that evidence would say, well, that explains, like, how Muhammad got his revelation. It's probably had epilepsy. And people who have epilepsy actually do have sort of supernatural-ish type experiences and sometimes hear voices.
Like
and sounds. Yeah, so. But why would you favor that? Why would you say, well, maybe he really wasn't hearing from God, and that's what happens when when a Gabriel comes or an angel overcomes you? You have like a physical reaction because of the spiritual power of this supernatural being. Yeah.
I guess is there a way to like hybridize the rationalism and the view that miracles do exist by saying, oh, there are these neurochemicals in our brains, they are chemicals, they have this very specific structure that we can see, but they were put in your brain by some greater being, and they act as a medium for you and that spiritual being.
But then I suppose that you might say, if we can explain it all with neuroscience, maybe it's the Occam's razor.
You know, why does science have to disprove religion? Why can't, you know, they kind of sort of mishmash together? It's the fact that Adam's bond is a miracle in and of itself.
Is it a miracle or is it a law of nature?
Yeah.
I mean, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, too. Like the strong and weak nuclear force, electromagnetism, and gravity, that's just, you know, those are the laws of nature. They are what they are. What's miraculous about them. It's something you experience every day. Patrick.
Now, what about like the monks who believe in the mind over matter thing and the transfer of energy, who can break like steel bars over their heads and
like things on the clock?
Puts like lean on spears in their throat and like bend the spear. I mean, the body is softer than steel, but yet they seem to be performing miraculous feats.
That's right. So what do y'all think about that? Monks performing miraculous feats. They lean on a spear on their neck and they're not impaled. Or they break a steel bar over their head. The breakers just bend.
I've seen it break.
Yeah. Huh. I would... Now,
I would say the same thing as I would about like David Blaine. It's like it's a trick, or they're doing something. Maybe they don't even know it's a trick, but they're doing something which allows them to do that. It might be like that. The spear isn't really that sharp,
or it could be the way that they.
Or they're not. Is they not as hard as it looks?
Like ripping a phone in half. Anybody can do it. You just have to do it right, and like, it doesn't take any strength. It's just
if you can just steal and like cool it really quickly, I think it makes it more brittle.
Maybe they do that. It's part of, and that might even be part of a monk ritual that they started way back when, and the guy doesn't know that that's why it works. You might think it's spiritual power. It's like walking on coals, right? You can walk on red hot coals if you do it the right way, but you got to like do it the right way, and it's because the coals are very pithy, and so they don't conduct heat very well. So if you stoke the coals the right way and let the ones on the top cool, you can walk across without burning your feet. And don't try this at home, folks, because occasionally people don't do it right and they get burned. But if you take a steel plate and you heat it to the same degree as those coals and you put your foot on it, you're going to be burned no matter what. There's no way to... And that makes you think that, you know, there's been all sorts of articles written on the coal walking. And it has to do with, you know, understanding the laws of physics. And I would suspect, like, the monks, it's a sort of the same thing. Although it might be that you maybe underestimate the powers of the human body to, you know, break bricks and do all kinds of crazy things. It's might be a lot of it, like, breaking things. It might just be adrenaline. It might be that if you x-ray those guys' skulls, they have a bunch of fractures, and they give themselves a skull fracture every time they hit themselves in the head.
They say we only use, like, 2% of our actual body strength at any given time.
Yes, you're capable, like, people are able to, like, lift cars, you know, when under at times of extreme stress, and that's adrenaline kicking in and make your metabolism go into overdrive.
Yeah, same thing with, like, yeah, to, like, not to think that, like, the Egyptians, like, that the aliens made the pyramids is also, like, it's, like, undermining human ability.
Yeah, you can actually look at the quarries. You can see the place where, like, you see this, like, stone obelisk, and it's, like, cut half out of the rock, and there's, like, this big crack going down the middle. I'm like, oh, somebody really got in trouble for that one. Pitched into the river or something like that. And you can see, like, the little chisel marks where they're, like, you know, chiseling around. This goes back to Clifford, I guess, looking for evidence. And just, you know, going on that, this Occam's razor, or put it in a slightly different way, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Was the Oracle of Delphi real or fake?
The Oracle of Delphi was a historical, you know, it was a historical institution. And there really was a woman, the Pythian priestess, who would speak for Apollo. But I don't think she had the power of prophecy. I think she had...
I read somewhere that they found, like, natural gases.
Yeah, so there's natural gas seeps there. So this might be the hallucinogen thing. Yeah. She was seeing dreams and visions because of the natural gas seep. Also, like, the Greek prophets, they would practice a thing called mirror gazing, where you'd stare into a dark reflective pool. And if you do that, if you stare into a mirror or a dark reflective surface for a long period of time, you start to have weird experiences. It's like being in a sensory deprivation chamber. And what happens is when sensory input goes away, and there's just like a little bit left in the periphery, your mind starts cooking up all kinds of stuff to fill in the gap. Yeah.
They have a cool little thing on YouTube that's exactly that. It's like these weird black and white stripes that move in a very specific pattern. And you're supposed to look in the center and not blink for, you know, a good minute or so. And when it stops, you look away and all this crazy stuff starts happening. Like, things look like they're growing and kind of shifting in and out of each other.
I think that's more of an after image.
Yeah.
Which is also pretty weird. But this is like, it's not an after image, but it's the lack of sensory input will cause you to your mind to try to fill it in with something, and so people start to have what they regard as spiritual experiences, but they're just all bubbling up from the brain and the unconscious mind. At least that's my view, but I think that's a rational view, because
I would say that this is right, that when you have a claim for the supernatural, that's an extraordinary claim. That's something which goes beyond the natural. And since it goes beyond the natural, it requires more evidence. And this goes back to Occam's razor, too, this idea that the simplest explanation is usually the truest one, and it's the one which uses the fewest explaining entities. So if we can explain supernatural experiences or religion or any phenomena just based on the known laws of science, then that's what we should do. It's only when we run into a case where there really no other explanation works that we'll have to look someplace else for an explanation. And it seems to me that that's a rational point of view, that you require lots of evidence for an extraordinary claim. What is an extraordinary claim? It's one that violates the laws of nature. So I think that Hume might be going a little too far by saying you'd never be justified in believing something is miraculous. That seems to be circular reasoning. But to say that to have a claim of the supernatural, that you require a lot of evidence and that it's legitimate to be prejudiced against a supernatural claim, that seems to be a rational way to think about all these sorts of things. So if I were to tell you that last night I was abducted by aliens, say, you'd be right to be skeptical. But if I were to tell you I have a twin brother, I think you should be less skeptical, because that's not, you've known a twin, you've seen a person who has an identical twin, you've seen twins on TV, you learned about twins in biology class, it's part of your everyday world. Whereas being abducted by aliens, probably not most of the, probably not part of the everyday world of most people in this class. So that will be it for religious knowledge. Next week, moral and political knowledge. Don't forget to post to the forum. And we'll see you on Monday.